From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour will be made when the final bell rings in Rochester schools later this month. School will be out for summer. When you were growing up, that probably meant a couple of months of fun, some freedom, finding friends to play. Well, in Rochester, for many families, it can mean uncertainty. And for teachers, it means a concern about summer learning loss. In particular, we know that kids in Rochester tend to be way behind on literacy. If they can't read and write by third grade, the outcomes tend to be very rough. And there's also a question on how we are approaching teaching in the classroom, particularly when there are challenges. Well, this hour, we've got a lot to discuss on various prongs of this. We're going to focus on the best ways to help kids in challenging situations. Pyramid teaching model, something you may not know about, but I'm totally fascinated by, and we're going to be talking about that with Lynn Lubecki. She's the executive director and CEO of RCN, Rochester Child First Network. Lynn, welcome. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you very much, Evan.
We do have a lot to talk about. This is one of those hours where we could, you know, there's so many different sort of threads to early learning. You tend to say that that's the most critical period, right?
It is the most critical period.
Why?
In our lives. Well, when we're born, but even before we're born, right, as we're being created, our brains are developing, our bodies are developing, our bones are growing, everything happens. We arrive into this world, and we have the first 3 years. Our brain still develops after we're born, right? And so little things like looking at a child's eyes and having conversations with them, talking with them, reading to them, just responding to them when they cry, all form connections in the brain. And that's those connections last forever. There's research out there that says by 5 years old, some of our values are set. Some of what we've seen in the first 5 years of life are set.
Wow.
How do we believe that this world that we've landed in is safe? Is an adult going to respond to us? We're dependent when we're born. And as we grow, we become less and less dependent on the adults around us, correct? So when we go off to college, when we go into life, all those different things, that the messages we receive from that first 6 months and 9 months and 2 years and 5 years. So if you think about that as a life skill set, when you're thinking about school, foundational learning, that's what we would call this, right? Foundational learning begins before birth, at birth, through that first critical 3 years, then 5 years.
Before we dive further into this, I think it's fair to say that someone like Lynn, I think you are very well served to do the job you do because of what you've gone through in your own life.
Sure.
And I read a couple of articles. You might have seen Lynn as a woman to watch in the Democrat and Chronicle. You told the Democrat and Chronicle, you have to have it hard to know that you have it good.
Right.
And you mentioned that, well, you know, maybe you didn't have the hardest of the hard lives, but you've had some hard times.
Mm-hmm.
Starting with the fact that when you were a senior in high school, you moved out of the house and started essentially on your own. Is that right?
I did.
Why did that happen?
It happened because we had a situation in my home that wasn't a safe place for me, in essence. And I was asked to leave the house, and you know, really good kid, doing the right thing. So here I am, I just turned 17, and I was on my own. I had to get a job.
Was this here? Where'd you grow up?
This was in Buffalo.
In Buffalo, okay.
It was in south of Buffalo. So I finished high school. I was on my own, and I finished high school. Got my first apartment when I was 17 years old.
Wow.
Was working at Dunn Tire for Mr. Dunn back in that day.
Mr. Dunn?
Mr. Dunn, I did. I went to school with his daughter, Kathy. And I was taking inventory for tires while I went to Bryant and Stratton. Back then, that was the track. There was a business track. There was a various tracks, and that was mine. Mine was business. And so I had an apartment, and I carried on from there. So I worked.
Do you live alone, by the way?
I do now, yeah.
No. Did you at the time?
No,
you
got, I did not.
I was going to say, did you have... What do you do when you're 17? You talk to friends, you figure out something?
I actually moved in with a boyfriend.
Okay.
You know, so it was a difficult, you know, I remember not being able to cook. And so I made a lot of rice. And I made chili and almost burned my father's, you know, mouth off when he visited one time. I was learning. I had to learn all my skills while I was on my own.
The things that maybe we should be learning a little older in life. You're 17.
Sure. My first car, I had to get transportation. Mm-hmm. It was not easy, and there were a lot of challenges. The good thing for me is I had a good social support, and I got through it because I had other people to help me, and I had resources, and that's part of the thing you learn to access.
Looking back at that experience in your teens, mm-hmm. how much do you think that benefits you for doing the work that you're doing now?
Well, one of the things it gave me is I felt that I had to look 20 to 30 steps ahead. almost to a a fault. Now I'm able, it kind of forced me into a visionary position. So it helped me anticipate things. The other thing it did is I'm very empathetic to people who struggle. No matter where I get to my life, I always know that it's not far away, no one's far away from being in need somehow. And so that it really helped me to, I was raised in a family that was very loving. And so we're taught to be very empathetic with each other anyway, whatever the deficits of the home was, that we were raised to be that way. But it also, I never forget how it is to struggle.
I think when you talk about that empathy, sympathy and empathy are different things. Mm-hmm. And for people who haven't gone through things like that, by the way, I'm in that category. I mean, I've been very, very, very fortunate. But the easy thing to do when you haven't gone through it is to then look at someone who is struggling and say, well, why don't they just X, Y, Z? And it sort of seems easy, right? Like, yeah. just get a job.
Just get a job.
Just get an apartment.
It doesn't work that way, yeah. Evan, right? You know that. We work with a lot of families I've seen a mom have to take two buses to get to work. One of the second buses, she'll drop off one child, then she'll get the bus to work, and she's late because a bus passed her. It was empty. And then you verify with the bus company, yeah, we have this problem. They pass people. They're with strollers. You can't understand how much of a struggle it is for often women, sometimes men and women, couples asking, they're without food. They paid their rent. They paid their car. They paid this so they don't lose it. But then they're hungry. There's not enough for food. It's often last on the list. So you have to recognize that people's struggles are real, and it's not as easy as if you just got a third job, right? If you just went to school, it's not always that easy.
And then you think about what you have to deal with if you get an unexpected problem.
Oh, yeah.
So for you, when you were 17, you probably didn't assume that all of a sudden you're going to be living on your own.
No.
Having to care for yourself, make food for yourself, figure things out. That's one thing. But sometimes there are unexpected crises or tragedies, medical crises. Mm-hmm. You've gone through so much in that scale, too.
Sure.
And that in the Democrat and Chronicle story on Lynn Lubecki, as a woman to watch, yeah, I'm reading this about your own personal background in your teens, and I'm going, wow, she's gone through a lot. Mm-hmm. You're a cancer survivor.
I am.
But you've lost a sibling.
I did. I did. My brother.
What happened?
My brother, in 2003, he passed. He was 36 years old. He had pancreatic cancer, and that kind of where it started for my family, because my sister turned 34, and she had stage 2 breast cancer. And she was tested well before it was known, the BRCA gene, because she was so young. She went through chemo and radiation, and I thought I was going to bury two siblings within a few years of each other. Wow. She got through it. She's nice and strong. A few years later, she gets tested. She gets the gene. She's convincing me from Maryland to get tested. The same week, this was in February of 2009, I found out I had the gene. I also found out I had breast cancer. So the first course of action for me, or the medical recommendation, was a bilateral mastectomy, followed with a oophorectomy. So my cancer was what you would call stage 0 or DCIS, contained. And my sister's was stage 2. So we ended up going through the bilateral mastectomies together. It was horrible. And it was like a 10-year period. I've always thought that I had my life in order. I had my priorities straight. When you start losing your siblings and realizing, well, we should all realize how fragile life is, because it's fragile. And it's a gift. Every day you breathe. What's a good day? Hey, I got up. I'm here.
Yeah.
And with every day, your responsibility is to give back, right? Your responsibility is to do something good for the world. And I was saying to my my exchange student, Sylvia, here today, that I'm fortunate that I get to work my dream. I get to work my passion, so I get paid to do what I would probably do as a volunteer if I were in another profession. Children are our answer, right? That's our future. Every second we make a difference in a child's life is a second we make a difference in the future. It's that powerful, and it sounds so dramatic, but it's not.
I had warned Lynn that I wanted to talk about her personal story first, just because I think it's inspiring, but I also think it does relate, because now when you meet families who all of a sudden they've got an unexpected medical expense, or imagine a single mom working, but then maybe break a leg or something happens and you can't work for a while, or maybe you lose the job entirely. Mm-hmm. You've gone through unexpected medical problems.
Yes.
You've seen your own family go through it. You lost a sibling way too young.
Oh, yeah.
Appallingly young.
And we miss him every minute of every day because there was three of us, you know, growing up together. But I can tell you that I was fortunate. I had people around me. My children were older by that point. And I think they were both in college, or my daughter was going to college. It was around that time. And I had medical insurance that was exceptional. I had physicians here that were exceptional. I called them the dream team. I had the best doctors you could ever find with the most up-to-date practice, which matters when we talk about teaching too, doesn't it? I had the best, you know, methods available at that time that made a very big difference in how I emotionally healed. It's just amazing. We're in the greatest city in the world.
Well, you're hearing from Lynn Lubecki, the executive director and CEO of Rochester Child First Network. So that's her story. and I really admire you, Lynn, because I think the work that you're doing now is helping families who deal with sometimes similar but their own challenges. Mm-hmm. And why don't you tell us, broadly speaking, what Rochester Child First Network is for people who don't know?
Sure. Rochester Child First Network is in its 159th school year. I'm so proud of that. We evolved in this great city. We had, at the time of Susan B. Anthony and Frederick Douglass, we had a group of women who were the wives of the men in the city, and they realized that there were begging and pilfering children in this city of great wealth. And they knew, you know, that literacy is the key to our democracy. You must be literate. You must understand. You must read in order to vote properly. So what they decided to do was bring these children in, and they couldn't go to the schools without shoes and looking all shabby. So they cleaned them up. They taught them to read. This evolved into the industrial school. So they taught them like Downton Abbey skills. I always say that, you know, making furniture. I tell the Mercy girls when they come that there was no Walmart, and they just look like, oh, wow. So furniture, and building furniture and cooking and all those things. And then it evolved into a nursery school. And now it's the network, Rochester Child First Network. And what we do is we have a special education preschool, a child care, a universal pre-kindergarten. You've heard expanded pre-kindergarten for threes. And we also have school-age wraparound care. We also support family child care providers who are caring for children in their homes, because we are one of the monitors for the Child and Adult Care Food Program. It's CACFP. It's a nutrition program. So we're like the monitoring and professional development arm of the government for that. So we do a network of services serving approximately 2,500 children in our community, 236 on our South Avenue site, and another 30 in the Sibley building. We have Rochester Child First Network Center City, so we've reached out a little bit.
It's a remarkable founding story, mm-hmm. and remarkable continuity mm-hmm. for this kind of a program.
Almost the same mission, Evan.
Also, alongside Lynn Lubecki is Andy McGowan. He's a project administrator for the Rochester City School District. Andy, welcome to you as well.
Thank you very much.
And they said that you're the data guy, that you capture the data that Rochester has on kids and helps condense it and report on it for local agencies. So data guy is the shorthand, but tell me about what you do.
I write reports. I evaluate programs. I go to meetings. I send a lot of emails. Lynn and I actually meet every 2 weeks regularly and more often irregularly as well, where we look at our going on 3,100 pre-K kids and how well are they doing? How well are the classrooms doing? Where are we pulling up weak? Where are we really strong? We don't have to worry about it. So I've been doing this for since 1989 when Peter McWalters was superintendent of the city school district, and I've been having a ball ever since for the most part.
Going on 3,100 pre-K kids, you said?
Yes.
In 1989, how many were in pre-K?
845.
Wow. What a difference. But give me
half day.
You kind of mentioned you look at what works and what's not.
Right.
What are some of the metrics?
Oh, we have many of them. First of all, we have parents fill out a form. We have them fill out too much. We know that. Parents, we're working on that, making it smaller, called the Parent Appraisal of Children's Experiences, where they tell us about their child's experiences. And that's really key. That's where we know, for example, that 30% of our incoming pre-K kids have never been to a dentist, or that actually parents are doing a fair amount of reading to their kids. In the classroom, we use a couple of things for kids. One is called the Core Advantage, the Child Observation Record. Anytime you hear the story, for every dollar you invest in a good pre-K, the community gets $6 back. That comes from the High School Project of Ypsilanti, Michigan, and they invented the Core Advantage. It's a low-stakes assessment of kids, and that's how we know kids grow about 20 months in a year in pre-K. We also use an instrument developed by Children's Institute, a great local organization called the Teacher-Child Rating Scale, that looks at social-emotional development of kids, which we find is actually, at this age, even more important than the academics. We look at the classroom in two different ways. We use two instruments, one called the Early Childhood Environmental Rating Scale, or ECRS, and the Classroom Assessment Scoring System, or CLASS. Both are low-stakes assessments that give teachers feedback. It gives them the roadmap on how to improve. We publish those data, and that's actually one of our claims to fame in Rochester is why we have, we use these data to, one of the things we found was we're among the highest performing systems in the U.S. and Western Europe. We're actually 1.7 standard deviations above the national average on both measures, actually. And what else do we use?
You are the data guy.
I'm a concept guy using the data in order to improve the program.
Lynn had a big smile on her face when you were mentioning some of those standards.
We're so fortunate here in this particular city because I could not do my job well. Remember, we said keeping our practice nice and fresh. Well, this data informs our practice right on the ground floor. Certainly me from my position, but teachers fill this out. They get the feedback. They improve they base their lesson plans based on what they know about the children. So we're going to talk about social emotional.
Yep.
It was this data set that inspired us to do both the summer learning and the teaching pyramid. It was very powerful.
So those are the two things that we asked our guests to come on and talk about this hour that we're about to dive into. This teaching pyramid and what's going on with summer learning, efforts at sort of retaining knowledge or helping kids at a young age, helping with literacy, the value there. So we're going to hit both of those. But listeners, I will also tell you, you've got two great resources in the studio. If you have questions or comments on early childhood learning at all in the city or elsewhere, this is the hour to do that. So if you want to call the program, it's toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or if you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. You heard Andy McGowan, a project administrator for the Rochester City School District, and Lynn Lubecki, executive director and CEO of the Rochester Child First Network. Okay, so this summer, programs, what's new? What's going on? I'll start with Lynn. What's going on there?
Well, a few years ago, we noticed that we've always known that, right? The during the summer, the 6 weeks of summer, the 10 weeks of summer, when children are out of school, there's a significant loss in both literacy and more in mathematical concepts and skills. And so when we saw, children make, like Andy said, 20 months of gain in that 1 year of 4 years old, and then they go on to lose between 10 and 30% of that learning before they enter kindergarten, it doesn't set up any of our children for success. So looking at this data, a group of community members in it, Jackie Cady is one of them, Luis Perez, Conger Gable. We took the Horizons model that's across the nation and put it into a preschool and wanted to do a pilot. We wanted to do a pilot of what would happen if we continued these children's education for 6 weeks out of the 10 weeks.
And again, they're how old the kids are?
These are 4 years old, 5 years old. They're between the UPK 4-year-old and kindergarten year. And we had great results by
for
continuing.
For 2 straight years now.
Mm-hmm. And again, great results means what? You didn't have that 10 to 30% loss? Is that what you're saying?
Right. Not only did we not lose, but the kids actually gained more in the summer.
Mm-hmm. And so was this an extension, a continuation of the same program? Was it different throughout the summer months? What was it, Lynn?
Well, what we did was we used our High Scope framework. We use High Scope, which is what Andy referenced earlier. And we also infused it with additional science and mathematic activities. You know, that could be playing in the water table and it's sand and dumping, filling and engineering and all that with blocks, all that. So we did the same kind of thing. We had extra staff in the classroom and we infused swimming twice a week. The Horizons model for older children does swimming every day. We did it twice a week because swimming gets children, there's a link between swimming and cognitive growth.
Swimming?
Mm-hmm. Oh, there's lots of research on that.
I didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
So We did the model. We called it Summer Leap, and with the support of our community and our data, we found that the children did not lose and in some cases gained. So we did it again, and now it's expanding. RCN has two classrooms we're taking on, and I know there's classrooms throughout the community. This has really been a combination of private and public funds, and our friends at the Children's Institute, Rochester City School District, we've all come together and said we're going to make a difference for these children, and we're doing it.
Okay. So with two classrooms this summer, right?
For RCN, but throughout the community there's...
At least 170, I think, right? Not as many as we'd hoped. We're hoping for more next year. We had a little hiccup in our budget this year. But we will be seeing at least 170 kids, I think, getting this.
Okay. We have 30 of them.
If you had the funding to do this for every child that needed it, how many kids would we be talking about, Andy?
There are about 3,100 3-year-olds and 3,100 4-year-olds in the city. Universal pre-K serves about 2/3 of them, about 2,100 to 3,100. So, parents have plans, other things happen, but we could certainly serve a few hundred more if the money were there. But kudos to our community partners and Jackie, Katie, Conger Gable, and others, Rochester Area Community Foundation. We really have a great stable of partnerships who have stepped into the breach and offered funding.
Okay. So that's going on right now. And are you seeing then, Lynn, a chance for these kids 4 and 5 years old to then hit kindergarten with a better chance to build literacy skills, to build other skills? I mean, is that sort of
absolutely
this foundational goal?
Yes,
right?
that's the goal. And we see it working. The process that we select children, we use the data, we use CORE, we use the TCRS, the Teacher-Child Rating Scale. That's like a social-emotional scale that we use. And we choose children who are at risk of losing those skills. So the teachers actually have a say in this. Parents have to commit to a full attendance. So it's a contract that we engage in with the parents and the families, of course, as our partners. And we target children who we think would benefit most. The other thing about it is that the design is to have 1/3 of the children who are more extended learners, those children who are higher achieving, mixed with other children that might be struggling a little bit. 1/3 and then 2/3 of children who are academically struggling, if they're emotionally and socially struggling, gives them more time to practice. Kindergarten is a very different world than the preschool world.
I want to address something as well that heard from a listener this morning, that we have some listeners who get very wonky on some educational policy details, which is fun. It's great for me because they're constantly communicating, did you see this study? Sometimes it's domestic, sometimes it's international, and I always find it fascinating because sometimes you feel like you're comparing apples and anvils, but sometimes you try to match it up as best you can. And somebody sent a note this morning saying, are we pushing kids too hard too early anyway? The Finns are getting a lot of attention for what they're doing, and there was a big story in The Atlantic about Finnish schools where students begin preschool, quote-unquote preschool, at age 6, and they prioritize play-based learning before then, so at age 3, 4, 5. In some Finnish schools, they don't even really start to try to read until 7, and yet by the time the kids are 17, they've got 94% who are literate at a high level, one of the highest rates in the world. And people are saying, are we missing the point at that 3, 4, 5-year-old? Do the Finns have it right? I don't know, first of all, about that data. I mean, I certainly trust
it's good
true.
Data.
But is it also unfair to compare something like Finland to an urban area where you may not have always the best sort of structural support at home, et cetera? So, Andy, you want to start there?
Well, what you're talking about is developmentally appropriate practices.
Okay.
You're absolutely right. Let 4-year-olds be 4-year-olds, 5-year-olds be 5-year-olds. And in fact, it's not just Finland, but in many of the top 10 performing schools in the world, they don't try to teach them to read until they're 7. So actually in pre-K and in Rochester in kindergarten, we do emphasize social emotional skill building, which is actually more important. What we're finding, even with our local kids, using techniques that Children's Institute is using called predictive analytics, that social emotional intelligence matters more than academics at this age. Academics is not unimportant, but if you're social emotionally strong, if you get along with your peers, if you work well with adults, you'll get all those academic skills along the way.
Okay. Lynn, what do you think?
I agree with Andy 100%. This community would stand together. Play-based learning is it's proven to work. Children learn concepts. They learn, as I was saying before, science and math.
But do they get college ready, Lynn?
Yes, they do.
I'm sorry to be flippant, but I haven't met anybody who works in your field who tells me that play-based learning is a bad idea.
Right.
So why isn't it more common?
Well, I think what you said about pushing the academics down and are we pushing children too fast, I think you can see in the numbers we're pushing children too fast. We have kids that are experiencing stress by second grade and our extended learners, some of the extended learners we send off to school, are crying because they don't feel successful. And we know this anecdotally. We know this with some data.
We have a joke. We're evidence-based, except when we're not. We're data-driven, except when we're not. One of the problems we see in early childhood is actually pre-K and kindergarten teachers don't go on to be leaders. They like the classroom. And we do have many fine leaders in there, but many of our leaders really don't have a lot of experience in the early years, so they don't understand developmentally appropriate practices and what it takes to get a child. You know, you're not going to get a fluent eight-year-old reader by pounding into them stuff that's inappropriate when they're only 5 and 6 and 4.
We've got on Twitter, Dr. Elizabeth Murray says, play is learning for children. So happy to have spent the past 3 years working with RCN for Kids. Go Dr. Lubecki. So, and Elizabeth is, I think she's a treasure in this community.
Oh, she is.
She's a spark plug. She's everywhere. She is ubiquitous. Let's get our only break of the hour, and then I'm going to come back and ask about the teaching pyramid,
sure,
which I think is important to try to understand this approach. So let's take this break and come back with Lynn Lubecki. She's the executive director and CEO of Rochester Child First Network, and Andy McGowan, project administrator for the Rochester City School District, which is evidence-based, except when it's not. But it's more and more evidence-based, it sounds like.
Fair enough. The data are on our side.
There you go. Short break. More with them next. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on The Next Connections, a casino in Rochester. The city is entertaining two proposals for a new performing arts center, one attached to a casino. And we're going to hear from some ministers who don't like what they heard from Mayor Warren last week when she said they were essentially being paid off to oppose the casino. They say that is not true. Then in our second hour, where's the public art, whether it's the airport or elsewhere? We'll talk about that. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. We've talked about this pyramid model briefly earlier this hour, and we're going to dive into it now because I think it's important for parents and for all of us to understand it. It's a pyramid model for supporting social-emotional competence in infants and young children. Lynn, where does it come from?
So the teaching pyramid model is it's a model that takes the best practices for infants, toddlers, and preschoolers from all different disciplines and puts it into a framework that promotes universal practices that happen all day long across routines and across the parts of the day. It happens at home, and it also creates a predictable and safe environment for children, whether they're in a classroom of infants or a classroom of preschoolers, provides them with routines and predictability and structure that makes them feel comfortable, right? And as we move along, it prevents challenging behaviors. So what happens if children know what their expectations are and the expectations are age-appropriate and clear and supported with visuals, then children will feel calm and they'll be able to have the best environment for learning.
And who put this together under sort of whose guidelines or how did it come together?
This is some of the best researchers in the whole nation. The Center for the Social and Emotional Foundations for Early Learning. I know that there's work from Vanderbilt University, from the University of South Florida. All these practices come together. There's a website called TACSE, the Technical Assistance Center for Social Emotional Learning. This is all available online.
Okay. And I think Megan Mack and I will make sure our Twitter accounts put it out if you want to check it out. So at Evan Dawson on Twitter, at MMack Media on Twitter. Megan is the producer of this program, of course. So let's kind of work our way up, if we could, in the pyramid, starting at the foundation. And if you're looking at the pyramid with us, it's yellow.
Mm-hmm.
The foundation of all the practices in the pyramid is systems and policies. And tell me about the foundation here, Liz.
Sure. So what's happening is that the teaching pyramid model is now coming into the it's coming into, I hear something, okay.
That's okay.
Sorry about that.
It's kid coming responsibilities.
Yes.
New York State is now adopting the teaching pyramid model across the whole entire state.
Okay.
Rochester Child First Network started this a few years ago, where we worked with Children's Institute, another incredible organization, with a model that was called BASIC. And we were inspired by this. And what's happened is we've been trying to implement the teaching pyramid model practices with fidelity across the agency. That's kind of a school-wide positive behavioral support program, if you will. So we're all doing the same thing for kids as far as practices go, consistent. So the you mentioned the yellow part of the pyramid. That was added later. And what that is if an organization or a system is going to change, you have to start at the top, right? You have to start where you have job descriptions that put expectations in there, that the leaders are fully on board and understand the benefits of this, where staff are engaging with each other in positive ways, adults, not just the children. So the systems piece is the big systems. It's things that support the rest of the pyramid. So in order to have a safe environment for our children and families, for example, at RCN or anywhere, you have to have a safe environment for the people who work there. We have to have a positive environment, work environment, that kind of an idea. Does that make sense?
Sure.
So that's the bottom. That's the systems part. We have contracted with and reached out to Dr. Rob Corso from Vanderbilt University. He's the Pyramid Model Executive Director, and a woman named September Garrity who they've come to us to help us do this and implement this with fidelity to make sure that we're doing it the right way. It's designed to be done a certain way. So then you move up to the next piece of the pyramid. And what we want to do is we want to promote social and emotional competence for children. Well, what does that look like? Again, just like you at work, we have to have an environment that's nurturing and safe. We have to have a predictable environment. We're trying to ask teachers, because our children come to us with all kinds of challenging behaviors. And I can talk to you about how many children RCN has, at least RCN, that have been expelled, thrown out of childcare and preschool. 2.5 years old, we have one child that was asked to leave because he was crawling through bookcases as opposed to putting books in them. He's 2.5. That's what they do.
Right.
So that expectations of children. So what are the practices that universal practices all teachers should do, right? And it's across all the routines. So for an example is having the same schedule every day reasonably, right? So you come in, you have a little greeting time. That's what our curriculum says. And at greeting time, we sit down, there's books available for you. It's having an environment that is safe and nurturing. All learning, Evan, takes place in a positive and healthy relationship between teacher and child, between child and child, between teacher and parent. All good learning happens when there's a positive and healthy relationship. You know, if you have a tense relationship between a child and a teacher, how much is anyone going to learn, right? And so our children will come to us with challenging behaviors. The teacher's response, we can't control how children land in our classrooms, how they come to us. We can't control how we respond, how we create the environment. And as you move through and those universal practices are in place, then it goes to the next level where we're looking for children who need targeted supports. So those are the children that might need a little extra support that we're going to make those adaptations for those kids. So they might need their own personal schedule in order to stay on task because they get a little nervous. Where someone else could look at the wall and say, okay, I know what comes next and I can use that, but someone else might need a little extra prompting. And then as you go up to the top of that pyramid, those are very targeted supports. Those are the kids who truly have possibly medical or a biological problem or some behaviors that are really intense, and we need to do something different for those kids. But it's unusual to have, 10 out of 18 children with challenging behaviors that are truly in that high level of need.
You need to go to the top of the pyramid.
Right. What they call that is sometimes when the pyramid is inverted. If you walk into a classroom and see a lot of challenging behaviors, we have to start with, what does the environment look like? What are our practices? Are we going through our rules? There's a whole bunch of that pieces to that. The whole idea is that children need to understand social and emotional. It's called social and emotional literacy, to actually have an understanding. That's how we gain self-confidence, self-esteem. We take risks. We feel loved. We're not alone. It's that kind of an idea.
I watched some 4- and 5-year-olds in their end-of-the-year ceremony in my son's class, and they did this little ceremony. And even for the kids, they did this thing where, and I know some parents think, why do we do a graduation ceremony for every age? It wasn't really a graduation, but they had
moving
put the,
up.
Moving up. They had put this little kind of a little footbridge on the stage, and they said that symbolized the child moving from class to summer. That's it. Mm-hmm. It was neat.
Yes.
But the kids had practiced it, and apparently some of the kids were really nervous about doing it. But they, my understanding is the staff had kind of worked with them to feel comfortable. And that, you know, the kids were told, you know, ultimately, if you don't want to do it, you're not going to be forced to do it. But we want you to know that it's fun and that your parents would like
exactly.
to see it. By the time we were there for the ceremony, they're all ready to go. They were so excited. Some of them were sort of posing as they went across the little footbridge. But it didn't just happen at the snap of a finger.
Exactly.
And every child viewed it a little differently.
Mm-hmm.
And I appreciated, just as a parent mm-hmm. of a four-year-old, I appreciated the fact that the school was working at understanding that it wasn't just, I'm going to tell you to do something, you got to go do it. And of course, I understand some parents who say, we need more discipline. We'll get to that in a second. But it was a system where the teachers and the staff said, every child's going to view this a little differently. Some love being in the spotlight. Some will want to go on the stage. Some will be very nervous about it. And they worked individually with it. And some of the kids needed more individual attention. It's a tiny example, but it seems to kind of correspond to what you're saying.
It's one of the best. It's a very good example. And here's the thing. We as adults, just like our children, we're whole people. We're whole children, right? So we have social, emotional needs, right? We have our personalities. We have our temperament. Some of us are quieter. You know, I'm Italian and Polish. And so when I see someone's quiet, I think they're hungry. Is everything okay? Are you sick? And of course, that's different. My temperament, my personality, my outgoingness, whatever it is, it's different. And that's how it is for children. They have physical needs, social needs, emotional needs, cognitive needs. So to recognize that this might be stressful for a child, maybe two children out of 20, maybe, you know, but those two matter just as much as the rest. So what happens is they practice, they give the opportunity. That's exactly what we're talking about, is supporting every child in their experience.
But here's where I want to think about teachers and staff in some organizations that may hear this and say, this pyramid model is a great concept that hopefully at the top, the kids who need the most intensive intervention, hopefully it's not a lot. You can identify that, you can work with them. And as you move down, then maybe, you know, maybe 5 or 6 out of 18 or 16 or 14, maybe 5 or 6 will need a little bit more emotional support. And then you kind of go down the list. But some teachers or staff may say, in my classroom, it may be 16 out of 18 at the top.
Right.
I don't have the support. And that kind of intensive intervention is almost impossible in some classrooms. Some may say that. What would you say to that, Lynn?
Right. And I understand. I first want to say that I empathize. I have been the teacher. I have been the administrator. And I have been in tears, and so have they. There is something about what we talked about earlier is there has to be an answer to this. It's very difficult. We go into this because we want to change the world. We want to help children. We want to do the things we do. And when we have a child with challenging behaviors or multiple children with challenging behaviors, teachers often feel like failures. And it's an awful feeling. It's nothing like it. So what you have to do is this set of practices that they've put together, again, these are not new. These are best practices in early childhood for many, many years. They've put them into one framework that if we do this systematically, it will solve the problem. It will help solve the problem, eliminate it. So what I always recommend is there's something called a teapot. It's a teaching pyramid observation tool. And there's another tool called Tippy Toes, which is for the infants and toddlers that has been created, that shows not only the practices, but tells teachers, and this is birth through 5, tells teachers what to do. Are you doing this? So I could ask the question, are you teaching friendship skills? Are you teaching explicitly friendship skills? Well, sure. Well, what are they? They're sharing. When do you do it? Well, when I see a child not sharing, oh, no, that's conflict resolution. Do you teach how to share, right? So it's very, it breaks it down into very small chunks so that we know, oh, wait a minute, I'm doing this. It's strength-based. I'm doing all these wonderful things. I have visual schedule. I warn children before there's a transition. I do all these great things. But, boy, I really have never taught options. Like I haven't taught how to engage another child in play. That's a friendship skill. Tap on the shoulder. Come on over and play with me. Or sharing skills. So that's the emotional competence. So it's a set of practices that allows us to self-reflect and look at our own practices.
even in those classrooms, you think they can do it?
Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
Andy?
And the data share that, and you had brought up some good points in terms of how much support do teachers have, and that's critical. First of all, class size is small, and pre-K it's only 18 kids. We'd love to see lower class size and other grades as well. Teachers are given support from a variety of ways across the city of Rochester. We have a whole team of technical support teachers, master teachers who go into the classroom and work with the younger teachers. And among the things we see is that because we have so much support, we see neophyte teachers grow to a master level in about 6 years. Normally, 10 years is usually the 10,000-hour rule. You've heard that and so on. And that's pretty common. But because our supports are so strong, we manage to truncate the time it takes from a neophyte teacher to really achieve master status in about 6 years.
Angela writes and wants to know, she said, interesting concept, but she said, can you explain again, is this being applied across New York State, the pyramid model?
Sure. Let me explain that a little bit. So Rochester Child First Network started to implement this. We have looked at this as a five-year implementation process. We're heading into year three.
Okay.
So it's not only getting the practices, it's informing teachers, it's getting that buy-in. RCN's at 95% buy-in right now. And we're just starting to put content out. This takes a long time. It's culture changing. New York State, which I didn't realize at the time, last year engaged with Rob Corso, again from the pyramid model, and is bringing this to statewide. And it happens that two of us in RCN, Mackenzie Albert and myself, are master cadre trainers. We've been selected out of, I think, 250 applicants. There were 50 selected, and there were five out of this area. And two of us from RCN were selected to participate. So we're trained to train in this. And so the state is now training and encouraging us. We have to do 90 hours a year in these module trainings to get people to use these practices. So it's very new for New York State. We're setting ourselves up at RCN to become a demonstration site, and the state is starting to teach us how to teach others. I know the city school district is interested in doing this in their preschool, so we're excited about that.
And you said 95% buy-in. What does that actually mean?
Well, you know, we talked about readiness. Just like anything, just like when we talk about children, you just can't go up to a group of teachers and say you're doing this. Our teachers, and Andy can speak to this, across the community, not just in the city school district, but every district, we have seen things come and go. The new best thing, this is the answer. This helps because, as we talked about, challenging behaviors are linked to social and emotional competence. Kids need to be taught skills, not punished. If the same child in timeout, you know, is always in timeout. Did you ever notice that? In June, they're still in timeout. Skills. We have to focus on skill development. And that's kind of where we are with this. It's the answer. But a lot of us have seen initiatives, and then they go. Or we'll get an initiative, and then the funding goes, and we're left without anything. So teachers need to understand and say, okay, I'd like to try this. They have to say, I'm willing to try this. And when they hear it, many of them do. They get excited.
I'm imagining some listeners hearing this saying, this sounds like the pre-K version of Rochester, the RCSD's new code of conduct, you know, which focuses more on restorative practices, which focuses less on expulsion and suspension, not in cases of violence, but generally speaking, less on suspending and expelling, more on trying to sort of work and nurture better behaviors. And yes, it requires more training and more staff support, but this sounds like a pre-K version of that. That's
fair to say, and I'll let Andy speak
to that.
We
have a no suspension policy for pre-K through 2 to begin with. But something Lynn said earlier, which is we're moving away from punishment-based, which doesn't work for adults either. Punishment-based systems never work, and the research is pretty clear on that. And certainly the need is there. I just wanted to recite a few statistics on that, and that is one out of five of our kids come to us in pre-K were neonatal intensive care unit hospitalized at birth. Over a quarter of them, 27%, have experienced the death of a close family member.
Yeah.
A fifth of them have seen violence in their neighborhoods.
Trauma.
And so it's trauma. And Lynn's point earlier about buy-in, about things come and go, What we've seen in Rochester is it takes about 6 years for something to go from the drawing board to be really fully integrated where it's not going away. A lot of teachers get skeptical because stuff has come and gone. But this is one of the things that has legs. And there are things, you know, this is where actually of all the promises made in the greater Rochester area over the last couple of generations, a couple of them have borne fruit. Reducing lead levels is one. But the promise of pre-K, the fact that we knew 25 years ago that more kids needed pre-K and it needed to be high quality, and we fulfilled that.
So let me, if I could, get into the weeds a little. Our listeners don't mind a little bit getting into the weeds. And in fact, listeners, one of my favorite new podcasts is called The Weeds. It's awesome.
It's a great title.
It is. It's called The Weeds. It's Vox.com, Ezra Klein, Matt Iglesias, Sarah Clifford. It's a weekly podcast called The Weeds, and it's wonderful. And it's policy wonky, but it's really well delivered. So a little bit of the weeds right now, because when you talk about getting teachers to buy in, Lynn, your dissertation, let me read the title of your dissertation, and then I'm just going to get out of the way. The Trans-Theoretical Model and Stages of Change, Predicting the Accuracy of the Stages of Change Scale for Early Education and Care 2.0 Self-Report Form.
Yes.
Which means, a short version means what? The dissertation was about what?
So this was fascinating and, of course, again, inspired by my colleagues at the Children's Institute and very much supported by them. We had a... The trans-theoretical model of change comes from smoking cessation. That's what that comes from. And it's been applied to everything from exercise, nutrition, physical, diabetes, everything. And there was one study that transferred it into education. And so Shira Peterson, who used to work for the Children's Institute, brought it to early childhood. And we really look at teachers' readiness to change, okay, a 1 to 5 scale. 1 means, I'm not interested. Forget about it.
I'm not changing.
It's not even just changing as a person, changing a behavior. I looked at responding to challenging behaviors.
Okay.
The second one is, you're considering, there's a change needed, but I'm not ready to do it. The third is like, okay, I'm open to it. The fourth stage is that I'm really open to it and I'm doing something. And then this is very general. And then the fifth stage is maintenance. So you've bought in. It doesn't mean if you're resistant to changing or implementing something new in your classroom or learning about it, it's not that we discard you or we fire you. It's nothing like that. It just means that you need to start at a different place. We had said that the one-size-fits-all approach for training and professional development doesn't work. Research supports that. We have to differentiate our instruction or our professional development for adults, no matter where you are, I'll say, but in this case, early childhood professionals. So if someone's a master teacher and they have to hear the same old thing again, it's very frustrating, right? It's the same thing. So what that means is that, for an example, if someone's in the stage 1 or 2 about using teaching pyramid practices, for example, we don't want to put them into a particular group where we're going to start saying, okay, this is what you do. We want to say, how's what you're doing working for you now? Let's do a pros and cons list. Let's talk about this together. What would you like to try? What works for you? Let's build on your strengths. And it's a very effective way to design professional development that actually works for individual teachers. Now, the readiness to change scale is very good. I think we can speak. The teacher report form is not as strong as the director report form. But for me, as an administrator, a director supporting teachers, it helped me improve my practice with my teachers. I wasn't, instead of saying, let's do this, I backed it off a little bit and changed my approach.
And for the most part, are you now confident that when you bring in, whether it's the pyramid model or something else, the teachers will embrace it over time?
Evan, what we did was we followed the implementation science. Yes, there's something called implementation science. And the teachers are running this now. I brought it to them. And then one by one, now we have a teaching pyramid guidance and support team. They make decisions. I get the money, I remove obstacles. My role is to remove obstacles and get them what they need. They tell us, and it's a multidisciplinary, led by teachers, administrators. We have special educators and general educators. We have assistants and aides. Everyone's guiding this effort now. It took some time, but once we got there, and they know all of our data is low stakes. No one gets punished for bad data, right? If you have a child or something goes wrong, we give it to them and say, how can we help you? How can we help you? And if it wasn't for our recap data, we can tell when something's effective. We can tell because the children's outcomes come, the classroom outcomes are good.
Annie, you want to weigh in there?
Well, I think low stakes is really the key, is that most teachers, and certainly pre-K teachers, early grade teachers, want to get better, but often don't know how. And between the instruments we use, the Eckers in the class, they're called, they get a clear roadmap as to where they're strong, where they're weak. On a whole school level, on a whole district level, the director of early childhood gets to see, okay, I need to put professional development here but not there because we're strong in one place but not so strong in other places. And so, but the whole idea is that nobody's punished, nobody's singled out. And this is why we see the explosive rates of growth among teachers.
Some of our listeners who might have only caught part of the program, they were asking about the summer program, which we discussed earlier. They were calling and asking. They said, I want a phone number. I want to get involved. I don't know if, you know.
On that note, too, though, is that we are accepting applications for three-year-olds in the fall. We have openings for over 1,000 three-year-olds.
Okay.
You have to be economically disadvantaged. If you have a child with an IEP or if you're an English language learner, you automatically qualify. It's 6 hours a day. Two meals are included. Bus passes for adults are included. Call the Rochester City School District or go online at rcsdk12.org/pre-K. That's rcsdk12.org/pre-K. And register your child. We have openings.
What's the registration deadline there, Andy?
There's no deadline.
Okay.
We'll be filling it in the fall. But we do hope that we have many more three-year-olds and 2,100 four-year-olds. And the four-year-old program is very robust as well. We have almost 200 classrooms all over the city. So you'll find the geography is helpful. You know, it's not going to require major effort to get your child to pre-K.
Okay. But, Lynn, for the listeners who said, I want in on that summer program.
The summer program is you have to be in our universal pre-kindergarten program in order to qualify.
Okay. But, you know, as we go forward, it sounds like what you've been working on, you've seen some success. You've seen some database success.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it's more broadly applied as we go forward. So last comment of the hour, I'll just ask Lynn, a year from now, 2 years from now, you hope we can talk and what else is going on?
Sure. Well, one of the things we're working on at Rochester Child First Network is a very, it's a phenomenal playscape. It's a nature-based playscape. We're you know, it's a $200,000 effort, and we're going to be starting that and breaking ground in the next few months.
So you got enough going on there.
Oh, we do.
Rochester Child First Network is online where?
It's www.rcn4kids.org.
RCN4, the number 4.
Number 4.
RCN4kids.org. If you want to check out the pyramid that we've been talking about, the teaching pyramid, Megan Mack and I have posted links to it on our Twitter account. And I want to thank our guests for the hour. Lynn Lubecki is the executive director and CEO of RCN. Thank you, Lynn. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Evan.
And Andy McGowan, project administrator for the Rochester City School District. Thank you, Andy.
My pleasure.
Our thanks to Deprina Godboldo, our intern, and Kat Schwarz is the engineer. Megan Mack is the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a lovely afternoon, and we will talk with you on a Thursday.